Hello and welcome to Maths on the Move, the podcast from plus.maths.org. I'm Rachel Thomas.
And I'm Marianne Freiberger.
So this is our first catch-up podcast of 2024. Marianne, this year you published an article about a really exciting discovery that happened last year, which even made the mainstream news. Someone discovered an aperiodic monotile called the HAT. Can you tell us what it means if something's an aperiodic tiling?
Okay, so, well, it's best imagined when you think about your bathroom. So most bathrooms are tiled in square tiles. And if you can easily imagine your bathroom extending in all directions. And then you will see that a square can tile the entire two-dimensional plane, right? And that's an example of a periodic tiling because you can pick it up and move it along by the length of a side length of a square and put it down and look, it will look exactly the same. It's periodic. Now, an aperiodic tiling is a tiling where you don't have this periodicity, so it doesn't always repeat. In fact, it's even stronger than that. So an aperiodic tiling is one where you can't get arbitrarily large periodic patches. So it's properly aperiodic.
And I know in the past we'd written about something called the Penrose tiles, which Roger Penrose discovered, which were used two tiles, two different shaped tiles to create an aperiodic tiling. What's so special about this new tiling that was discovered last year?
Well, it uses only one tile, right? So Roger Penrose, that was already considered a big breakthrough that he found aperiodic tilings that use two different shape of tiles. But in this case, you really only need the one shape, which is called the HAT, or it's sometimes also called an Einstein, which is German for one stone. So it's not called like that because of the physicist, but because it's one thing, like it's one stone.
And who discovered this tiling?
Well, that's another interesting story. And I think that's part of the reason why the story went so big is that David Smith, who discovered the HAT, is not a professional mathematician. He is somebody who looks at tiling and plays around with them in his spare time. So he discovered the HAT, and when he had a suspicion that it really was an aperiodic monotile, he then brought in mathematicians who verified that and also provided a proof that the HAT really is an aperiodic monotile.
And you got to meet them last year, didn't you?
Yeah, I did meet three of them. So last year in December, David Smith himself, Joseph Myers and Chaim Goodman-Strauss, so these are two of the mathematicians who helped, they were all in Cambridge, and there was a talk about the HAT, the aperiodic monotiles, and I had the chance to chat to them for a bit. The one person who wasn't there, who was involved in the proof, was Craig Kaplan.
And it wasn't just a talk that you saw?
It was just a talk, but what was interesting about it is that they introduced a competition called the Einstein HAT competition, which was launched last year by the UK Maths Trust and the MoMath, the Museum of Mathematics in New York. And the competition asked people to get creative with a HAT and to send in things they had made with a HAT. And the results, which they showed us pictures of, are really, truly amazing. So, you know, somebody made ravioli in the shape of a HAT, and people had, you know, they made fabrics with a HAT design out of which they made dresses. And there were plenty of pies and cakes and things like that. And, you know, one lady made a dinosaur design out of the HAT tile. And it was quite amazing what kind of lengths and depths of creativity people got up to.
It's so nice to see maths really excite everyone, and that to show that you don't have to be a mathematician to play with maths and to really enjoy the mathematics. And also, it's always nice to be able to eat some mathematics.
Oh, yes, that's always the best. And actually, do you remember when we were at the Heidelberg Laureate Forum last year? It was the 10th anniversary of the Heidelberg Laureate Forum, and somebody made a lovely birthday cake, which was decorated with the HAT.
That's right. It was delicious as well.
Yeah, it was very good. So it was a lot of fun eating that particular piece of mathematics. So, Rachel, what was one of your favorite things you've worked on this year?
Well, I was really pleased because earlier this year we finished a project we've been working on across the whole of the Millennium Mathematics Project, which is the umbrella organization that PLUS is a part of. And we finished a project which is called Contagious Maths, and we've been working on that for over a year, I think. It's with our director, Julia Gogg, and she won a Rosalind Franklin Award for her work and for her proposal, which was about connecting her research with classrooms and with kids in classrooms. So Julia gave this brilliant Royal Institution Christmas lecture in 2021 about her work during the pandemic, modelling the spread of diseases. And obviously, in particular, she came to prominence as part of the SAGE group of scientific advisors to government during the COVID pandemic. And she gave this brilliant Christmas lecture where she was getting the students in the room to interact and play with mathematical models and build their ideas. So the Contagious Maths Project was a chance for Julia to work with all of us across the MMP to find a way to tell that story and to find a way to allow people to play with the ideas that she worked with and the ideas about building mathematical models to understand disease.
Yeah, it was really fun. We developed a series of very short video clips with Julia explaining all there is to know, really, about building mathematical models from the ground up. And we filmed them with our amazing videographer, Howard France.
Yeah, it was great working with Julia and with Howard and sort of finding a way to tell that story. And as well as that, Julia had these fantastic ideas for interactivities, which our colleague Oscar from our sister project, Enrich, developed into these fantastic online interactivities that you can play with. And you can find all the video clips and all the interactivities to play with on plus.maths.org if you search for Contagious Maths. So you can have a go yourself and discover everything there is to know about understanding diseases using mathematics. Now, Marianne, I know you've been working on something very entertaining to do with slime mold. What was that all about?
Yeah, so that was really fascinating. This is something that I learned when I talked to some people who were organizing a research program on the mathematics of movement at the Newton Institute next door. So apparently there have been experiments with a type of slime mold where people took a map, for example, a map of Tokyo and its surroundings, and they put a little bit of slime mold in the middle of it. And then at the important sort of locations within this map, they put the slime mold's favorite food, which I think are rolled oats. And then the slime mold kind of started spreading out in order to get to that food and to transport the nutrients around. And it actually ends up sort of imitating a human-made transport network. So all by itself, without having a brain and without being hugely intelligent at all, in fact, probably you could say not intelligent at all in the kind of classical way, it manages to find exactly the same solutions to creating a transport network as humans do. And actually, some people even say that the slime mold is capable of solving the famous traveling salesman problem, which is something that human mathematicians find very hard to do.
It's fascinating to think of slime mold being able to mimic the kind of work that we do. But the mathematics is also involved in other applications, more immediately important applications.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what this slime mold example shows is that you don't need to have a brain in order to move around in interesting ways. And the Mathematics of Movement program was precisely about bringing together two communities that are interested in movement. So there's a community that is interested in large animals and how they move around, essentially in ecology. And there's a community that is interested in how tiny things, such as cancer cells, for example, how they move about. Now, each of these communities have developed their own mathematics to understand the movement of the things that they're looking at. For example, that involves things like random walks that some people may have heard of. But the two communities haven't come together as much as they perhaps could have and exchanged their ideas. And the Mathematics of Movement program made it possible for those two communities to get together and to exchange ideas. And it had some really interesting results. So, for example, people on the ecology side have long known that when you're looking at a swarm of birds or perhaps a shoal of fish, it is possible to fool these animals into following a robotic leader. So you if you can imagine a flock of birds and you have some sort of a drone, I suppose, if it behaves in the right way, you can fool the birds into following that and recognizing it as a leader. Now, some people in that Mathematics of Movement research program then had an idea, which is that could you potentially also fool cancer cells into following a robotic fake cancer cells? Because cancer cells also move about in a way that can be described in a similar way as you can describe the movement of birds, say. And if you could do that, then you could perhaps persuade a cancer not to grow in directions that are really damaging to the person that has it. So that's an amazing idea.
And it's such an interesting example of the kind of exciting work that happens at the Isaac Newton Institute, that it's this bringing together of people from across different disciplines or different areas of mathematics and the exciting work that happens across these boundaries. And you can find out more about that work in the show notes about or going to plus.maths.org/INI.
So the Newton Institute is next door to the Center of Mathematical Sciences, where PLUS is based. But Rachel, you talked to a more immediate neighbor within the Center for Mathematical Sciences.
Yes, it was really exciting to talk to Oscar Randall Williams about some research he's working on. And yeah, it was great because we're talking to him about the work he's doing right now and a chance to sort of get a glimpse of new research at the cutting edge of mathematics as it's happening. Oscar works in an area of maths called topology, which famously you can think of things being equivalent in topology if you can bend or stretch them, but not cut or tear them from one shape to the other, then they're equivalent in topology. So the famous example is that a coffee cup is equivalent to a donut with a hole in it, because if you dent one side of the donut and sort of push it in and squish it out, you end up getting the coffee cup and vice versa. So Oscar, who just has a great turn of phrase, talked about fear that he was motivated by being outraged by not knowing things. And the thing that he was outraged by was there's these, the kind of spaces that we all learn about at school, which are things pinned down by axes. So like an axis, you draw on a graph where you have a vertical and a horizontal. Or if you think about the real world we live in, which we know has three dimensions, vertical, you know, then left, right, and forward, back. If you can pin down your space by these three, by perpendicular axes, then that means that you have got a Euclidean space. And that's sort of the most basic space you can have in topology. And Oscar was outraged because we can't describe all the symmetries of the Euclidean spaces. It's been known for quite a long time how you can describe all what are called the smooth symmetries. So they're the symmetries we're used to thinking about, like rotations or reflections. But there's these other kind of symmetries called continuous symmetries, which aren't so straightforward. And there was no known description for those. And Oscar described it, the difficulty about continuous symmetries, by saying that they were like looking at the sun. They were too difficult to study directly. So instead, Oscar and colleagues have developed this new way, this sort of change of perspective that allows them to think about continuous symmetries. And they believe they're really close to having a complete description of all the continuous symmetries of Euclidean spaces, which would mean they've finally answered this question that he was outraged by. And along the way, this description actually shows that there's a really surprising connections between this area of topology with areas such as theoretical physics and other parts of mathematics, which are really quite unexpected. So it was really exciting to get a chance to talk with someone about the research they're working on right now, sort of extending our fundamental understanding of some very pure parts of mathematics.
And it's amazing that often there are some things that you'd think of as quite fundamental, but they're still not understood. And then it's about looking at things in a different way often that gets people to a solution or to a better understanding. And then it never sort of ceases to amaze me that these things, which are very, very, very pure mathematics, end up having applications in physics and places like that.
And by answering these questions opens up yet more sort of directions for research for everyone to go on to after. So it's just you answer one question and you open up several more.
Yeah, topology is not dead.
So we've been doing quite a lot of traveling. You're talking to me from Germany. How is Germany?
Germany is good. It's a bit rainy, but it's good. It has a lot of nice cake.
I love a Kaffee und Kuchen in Germany. And I'm here in London where it's sunny for a change, which is nice. But a week or so ago, we were lucky enough to travel to Bristol for two conferences. Marianne, the first conference we went to was one for our colleagues from Maths for DL, the Maths for Deep Learning.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And we've had two recent podcasts talking about machine learning, which is, of course, the most powerful recent advance in artificial intelligence. And the Maths for DL conference was really interesting. There were people looking at all the things you can do with machine learning. One talk we particularly liked was by Nathan Kutz. And we'll be talking to him soon, and there'll probably be an article or a podcast about his work. But what I found so amazing is that he was talking about ways that developed in which you could capture the movement of an entire human being by just attaching one sensor on their wrist. So that sensor could perhaps be a smartwatch or something. So if you think about motion capture, which is something that you might have seen that gets used in movies, for example, where lots of sensors are attached at crucial points in a person's body, knees, hips, hand, feet, head, and so on. And
you see those movie stars and they've got those suits on with dots all over their bodies.
Yeah, exactly. And they work by recording the movement of the person at all these different points of the body. But what Nathan was saying is that with machine learning, you can actually develop ways of capturing all this information by just having one point on the body where this movement is recorded, which is quite amazing. And it's not just of use in movies. It is also of use in making prosthetics for people. Because if you're going to get, say, a prosthetic leg, for example, then it helps if people understand the way you move, if they understand your gait, because that way they can make sure they give you an appropriate prosthesis. So this kind of technology has uses beyond the entertainment industry. It could be really important to people.
And the other conference we were in Bristol for was with our colleagues from the Juniper Research Network, who are people working in mathematical modelling of the spread of infectious diseases. And as usual, really interesting speakers to hear from them. And also we had an opportunity to run a communications workshop ourselves, which although we were theoretically teaching people how to communicate their research, it was also a fantastic opportunity for us to hear about the research from all of the people attending. Did you have a favorite example, Marianne, of one of the research stories that came out of our communications workshop?
One thing that I found really, really interesting is work that is being done by Liz Fearon. So Liz works on essentially mathematical models in order to understand the spread of infectious diseases. But she's very much interested in how we can include people, so the population in building those models, because people's experience, whether they're scientists or not, is important, and that's what we need to take into account when we're building mathematical models. I mean, there's plenty of examples of it from COVID, where it became really clear that people's behavior it's really essential to take it into account. For example, if we remember the idea that we were not meant to go to work if we tested positive for COVID. However, there were many people who had no choice but to go to work because they wouldn't get paid otherwise. So what they would do is simply not test. Now, these kind of things you need to take into account when you're building mathematical models. And to find out about these kind of things, what you need to do is talk to people. So this idea of including people in the process of building mathematical models, I think, is really interesting.
And the other thing that came out from talking to Liz and many of the other researchers there was the importance of nuance in how you communicate sort of the research findings to different audiences, and that you really need to understand, say, if you're working in sexually transmitted diseases, you really need to understand the priorities and wishes and sensitivities of the audiences that you're trying to communicate with when communicating with them. So I think although we were theoretically teaching them how to communicate, I think I was learning as much from them.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
And one of the reasons some of them have so much experience is they did a lot of work communicating with groups like policymakers and civil servants. And there were some interesting talks by people from government at the Juniper workshop. And it's really interesting to hear both sides of the researchers talking to the policymakers and the experience of the policymakers having to absorb and act on mathematical research. And we're looking forward to working with some people on developing ideas for communicating maths with policymakers in the future.
Yeah, so there'll be some content from those two conferences appearing on plus.maths.org very soon. And looking at you, Rachel, we're recording over Zoom and we're both currently finding ourselves underneath some blankets, because that's what we learned during COVID, is that in order to improve the sound quality, you create your own little recording studio by putting a duvet over your head. And we actually found out how important surroundings are when recording when we were on the Clifton Suspension Bridge in Bristol the other day.
We were trying to record a podcast from the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which was so beautiful and so impressive, and the view was so great. And it was just a few minutes walk from where the Maths for DL conference was. But it was really windy. And so we have returned to living rooms, recording over Zoom with blankets over our head. So we will leave you with that image, Marianne and I crouched over computers with blankets over our head for your listening pleasure, hopefully.
True professionals, as
true
always.
Professional. So you can find, we'll put some links for the material that we've talked about in the show notes. But stay tuned to plus.maths.org for more exciting content and stories from the world of maths soon.
Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Bye.